We pin a lot of hope on medical research, with a lot of public and private money going into basic science and the development of medications and other treatments. The goal is to see cures for life-threatening illnesses. And there have been a lot of success stories over the years, from AIDS medications to chemotherapy. But our next guest says there's a fundamental problem in biomedical research, not just that some diseases remain uncured or that promising treatments fail on closer study. He says a lot of the basic research in biomedicine is fundamentally flawed, leading science up blind alleys, creating false hope, and wasting a lot of money. Richard Harris joins us now. He's a science correspondent at NPR and the author of the new book Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Pleased to be here.
Well, what were some of the first signs you saw that there was a problem with biomedical research?
Well, one of the most notable studies came out a few years ago, and it was done by a researcher who is the head of cancer research at Amgen, a drug company in California. And he decided to take a look at some of the more promising scientific results he saw published in the scientific literature, figuring if these studies are correct, these are great leads for new drugs. But he couldn't get them to work in his laboratory. And after a while, he decided, I'm going to go back and I'm going to try to redo about more than 50 of these experiments, 53, and see if I can get them to work, and even go to the original scientist and say, hey, I'm having trouble with these experiments. Can you help me? And he did as much as he could to see if he could reproduce those 53 studies. And of those, he was only able to reproduce 6. That's 11%. And that was a pretty shocking result. And as it turns out, he was the second person to have done something like that, because at the same time he was doing that work, there was also an experiment going on, a similar experiment at the Bayer drug company in Germany. And they could only reproduce 25% of their experiments. So this was a big red flag for the community at large that, hey, we need to be less confident in the studies that we see published in the scientific literature.
And then that core problem, basic research that nobody seems to be able to replicate, how does that cascade into wasted research time and money?
Well, science is hard, and I'm quite sympathetic to scientists. They're on the frontiers of knowledge, and we shouldn't expect every experiment to be correct, of course. But the real issue is how much of it is wrong, and how do you sort of separate the wheat from the chaff? And that has been the problem. When you have that many experiments or that many published results that are misleading, it can really send the fields in the wrong direction. People can say, oh, here's an exciting result, and they'll start to build on it, and it may take quite a while for them to realize that the original result wasn't correct in the first place. So this is kind of leads to a wasted effort. And you'll always have some wasted effort. But my book focuses on some of the efforts, some of the things that can be done to streamline this process so you have less wasted effort. You have more, you have more results that are published that are correct in the first place, and easier to tell when something is wrong, that it's something that's just not worth pursuing and time to move on to some other idea.
Yeah, you find a lot of causes for this kind of research going wrong, being non-replicable. One point you make is that the ecosystem of basic research in science is often set up for failure. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, this is a sad story of what's happening with the culture of science these days. And in some ways, it's driven by the fact that there's really not enough money to go around. There are so many scientists fighting for a shrinking pool of research dollars. Most times, scientists spend a lot of effort writing a proposal for a new grant to fund their research, and most of those are turned down. Even really fine ideas get turned down. So this cranks up the pressure, and unfortunately, it creates a hyper-competitive environment, this quest for money. So all of a sudden, if you need money, you have to say the research that I've done is, sparkling, perfectly clean and so on, and with dramatic and really interesting results. And it encourages people, unfortunately, often unconsciously, I think, to make their results seem better than they really are and not to admit their errors and the flaws and the cracks and their uncertainties and so on. And this perpetuates the idea that that things aren't as good as they could be. And the rewards are really for doing stuff quickly and for maybe not doing that final follow-up experiment that might deflate your results a little bit. And the system, unfortunately, is not geared for optimal science. Scientists really have to choose, do I want to do what's best for my career? And I understand that. They want to keep going and they want to keep pursuing their ideas. Or do I do, the most careful possible science that might actually harm my career?
And another source of that kind of bias to want to think you've got something significant, you write, is a lot of people go into this line of work because they want to help people. They want to come up with a cure. If they've got that initial result that looks like it could be really promising, there's a part of their brain that says, yeah, run with that. And it trumps the part of their brain that says, let's find out what's wrong with this.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not unique to scientists, of course. We all like to look at the world that way. And it's we see the world as, you know, through our own particular lenses. And I'm totally sympathetic to that. But the scientific process is designed to help scientists avoid those kinds of pitfalls. It's why you're not supposed to know in advance, how your results are going to turn out. You're supposed to, scientists called it blinding, where you're not aware of whether you're looking at the control studies, the people or the cells that are not expected to change, or the ones that you've treated with a chemical to see if they do change. So there are all sorts of ways that science is designed to avoid these kinds of pitfalls. But there are so many ways that you can fool yourself that it's a really, really challenging task to avoid fooling yourself.
Another source of problems is sometimes in animal studies, you write, the sample sizes are small because they're set not by how many tests would be significant, but by how much the researchers can afford to do.
Yeah, that's another consequence of having not enough money in biomedical research to do things correctly. And the classic example I talk about in the book is involving ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And there have been many, many false leads based on animal studies that were just far too few animals that were mice that were done in these original studies. And people just, to do these studies correctly takes dozens and dozens of mice. And that it can cost, a single experiment can cost well over $100,000. And if you're a researcher dependent upon a federal grant, you're not. It's very difficult to amass that kind of money to do the experiments, with all the bells and whistles. And I don't mean that in that those are excessive things to do. Those are actually the essential things that you need to do to be really confident in your results. And there is an outfit called the ALS Therapy Development Institute that actually does put the resources into doing these experiments correctly. They're based up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they redid a bunch of the experiments that really looked promising and led to a lot of failed experiments for drugs for ALS. And they redid the mouse studies correctly, and they said, oh, we can understand why these experiments failed. If you actually do them with enough mice and you do all the other careful things you need to do to structure these experiments correctly, they did not see promising results in their mouse studies.
Staying with those mice and other animals, something I actually was kind of surprised to read in your book was a lot of the animals we test on maybe don't tell us that much about what a human is like. We're so different. Even something that might work in mice might not work in rats, much less humans.
It's true. I think we have an exaggerated expectation that, well, we're mammals, they're mammals, therefore what works in them is going to work with us. But cancer's been cured many times in mice. All sorts of diseases have been successfully treated in mice. And then when you try to take them to human beings, it doesn't work. The animals are still valuable as experimental models for sort of understanding some of the basic parameters of how biology works, but we are very, very different, and very often those don't translate. So I think it behooves us to be really careful when we see experiments results in mice, not to say, oh, this is going to work in people. And unfortunately, we journalists sometimes just get quite excited about experiments that are reporting exciting results in mice, and I think scientists maybe get a little bit overexcited too and think, wow, here's, this is going to pan out. Maybe occasionally they're worthwhile leads, but caution is advised.
We're talking to NPR's Richard Harris about problems with biomedical research. His new book is called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how biomedical research is done? If you or a loved one have participated in a clinical trial for a medication or other treatment, what was that experience like? And if you're involved in health research yourself, what do you think could be done to improve the system? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to NPR science correspondent Richard Harris about research in biomedical sciences. His new book is called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about medical research? Have you been part of the research system as a patient in an experimental study or as a scientist? What did you see? What could work better? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Richard, we covered just a few of the reasons that research can go wrong. What are people doing now to try to get over some of the flaws that lead to misguided searches for cures?
Yeah, that's a good question, because actually people are quite concerned about this, scientists are, and now that they're becoming aware of the problem, they are thinking about what sorts of things they can do. And they're pursuing a bunch of different ideas, and I think some of the most intriguing ones are discussions about how to make science more transparent, so that when a scientist publishes some results, they also put out their original data and their computer code so other people can quickly replicate the experiments and do their own analysis and see if it's correct or not. This is not always popular, because people are worried that they're also giving away some of their intellectual property in the process. But on the other hand, we as taxpayers, generally speaking, fund this stuff. So I think it's fair game to say, let's put it out there and let people talk about that. So that's one idea. I think another thing that I saw hopeful signs of is scientists realizing that young scientists needed to be trained a little bit better on this, because they don't necessarily get formal training on the best way to design an experiment and how to avoid all of these various pitfalls. So there's a new interest and focus on improving scientific education for graduate students and beyond. So some of these avoidable problems will be avoided.
Let's go to our callers now. Vicky is on the line in Oregon. Vicky, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the increase in the pseudoscience has made it harder for true scientific researchers to get funding, because they're competing with people who are competing for money from people who think that, vaccines cause autism, or and therefore science is flawed, or, this and such new superfood is going to cure cancer, and, people aren't going to spending money on research, because
yeah.
Science is just trying to make us sick kind of thing. Mm.
Well, the National Institutes of Health, which doles out the most of this research dollars for this kind of work, and they give more than $30 billion a year out or spend on their own campus, that process is a very careful process. And it's actually, they recruit scientists from around the country to sit and judge these experiments that come in. So I think the NIH is not diverting money to dubious scientific experiments. If anything, I think the NIH process is very conservative, and sometimes scientists complain that the more interesting, sort of far out there ideas that are well grounded in science actually don't stand a chance against sort of safer experiments that are more likely to succeed. And so some people wish that the NIH would be a little bit looser, just to allow some of these somewhat unorthodox ideas in, because sometimes those are the ones that yield the biggest results. But we're not talking about oddball theories. We're talking about real science, but just unusual, sort of off-the-beaten-path kinds of ideas.
Vicky, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Andy in Manitowish Waters. Andy, hi.
Hi. Mine's going to be a little bit different. I was a superintendent on a construction project about 14 years ago, and it was a building for raising hogs for organ transplants. Building was probably in the neighborhood of $10 million. And we were 2 weeks from completing the project, and someone said to the drug company, did you run this past the FDA? And they said, no, we should probably do that. Well, they got turned down, and the building sat empty for 5 years.
Hey, Andy, thanks.
Wow.
That sounds like a lot of money wasted. I don't know. That's maybe even beyond the research scale. But, Richard, any thoughts on that?
No, that's a fascinating story. I hadn't heard that.
So do you see, Richard, as we start to wrap up, is there a culture change since those two studies you mentioned at the outset came up that, hey, we're starting to move in the right direction here?
Well, I think there's clearly an interest in doing that. And in fact, the NIH has put out some new rules to say, hey, if you're going to be using, for example, living cells, you need to verify that the cells are what you think they are. Because quite often, scientists think they're using, for example, a liver cancer cell, when in fact, they're studying a cervical cancer cell, because they haven't bothered to actually verify the identity of the cells. And the NIH is saying, enough of that. That's an easy problem to fix. From this point on, we expect you to verify your cells. So they're very practical things like that that are happening. There are also scientists who are, you know, thinking the big thoughts and sort of saying, how do we change the culture of science? And it's hard because it's driven by the funding crunch, and that's not easy to fix, for sure. But sort of these cultural ideas that have crept in, cultures don't change quickly, but they can change. And in fact, there were somewhat similar problems to these that were plaguing clinical research, that is, experiments with human beings of new drugs and so on, back in the 1990s. And there were a lot of avoidable problems with those experiments. And people swept through that. They looked at those systems, and they've cleaned that up quite a bit, actually. Not perfect, but that is much improved. And so the people who were involved in some of those projects to improve that process are now turning their attention to these laboratory results and saying, look, if we can get higher success rates from these laboratory results, that means we can accelerate the progress in developing new drugs. We can avoid a lot of the dead ends, the missing, the bad directions, and so on. And basically, we get more bang for the buck, more value for the research dollars we're putting in. Research, as I say, research is hard. You're never going to be perfect or close to it. But the trick is to, you know, recognize when you're on the wrong track and make an adjustment.
We'll leave it there, Richard. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Rob. Thanks.
That was Richard Harris, science correspondent at NPR. We've been talking about his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions.